to Fireside Chat, and welcome to another recording of our episodes. Today we are recording episode 133, believe it or not, and I'm honored and I have the distinct pleasure to have with me Marcia Clark, and we'll get to know Marcia in a second. This episode, we're going to be focusing on women leadership, coaching, and strengthening women in their value to the society, to the industries, respective industry that they're working in, and how can they best contribute to the world. And for that, I have the champion with me today. Marcia Clark is an entrepreneur, best-selling author, 2 books already, at least the one I know about. Maybe there are more I don't know about. And a facilitator, a coach, and a speaker. And the list goes on. And ex-EDS turned out to be a Hewlett Packard later on.
Yes.
I'm honored to have you with me all the way from Texas. I think you're in Texas. At least that's what it says on your profile.
That's right. And thank you very much, Robin. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today and to have a conversation about this, because to me, it's one of the most important conversations we can be having.
Absolutely. And you hit the nail on the head. I work in the localization industry, and the localization industry is a predominantly female occupied industry. Higher percentage of our workforce is female. We have many associations language industry, the women in localization, for instance. That's an association led specifically for women in the localization industry, which I support. I've interviewed many of those individuals on my podcast to increase the visibility and the voice out there supporting the cause, if you will. I think it's an admirable thing for all of us to keep pushing in the same direction on it, regardless of gender. I make sure that this is forefront in our minds. I realize I'm male, female, talking about a woman's issue here, but still, I think there's a lot of benefits for increasing the voice out there for this cause. So what do you think of that?
Well, I agree with you. And I'm absolutely fine having a conversation between a man and a woman. What I'm not fine about is if you're in rooms representing me and you don't even know what I think. So I love that you're initiating and having these conversations, because our voices need to be heard. I mean, our stories need to be told. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of my favorite quotes is by Sally Resch Wagner that says, "History isn't what happens. History is who tells the story." That's why it's so important, I think, for us to be asked what we think and to be invited to the table and to have our voice be available for decisions and so on. And now more than ever.
100%. So let's get started, Marcia, by getting to know you a little bit. Okay. So I want you to take this. Imagine yourself sitting at a bar stool after a conference, somebody beside you. And, you know, somebody says, tell me a little bit about yourself. How do you introduce yourself in a relaxed environment? Let's put it this way.
Okay. All right. Right. So I am an entrepreneur. I'm a businesswoman who's in the business of leadership and executive development. And I deliver my services through programming, through books, through podcasts, through online training, through keynote conversations. I call them not speaking, because I like to have the conversation part. And that I grew up in a world of technology, and that I learned a lot about business in that regard. And I learned a lot about being a leader and how to develop other leaders. And I'm passionate about supporting women and helping them define success on their own terms.
So this is great. When I read about EDS, that's a name I haven't heard for a while, since 2000, right. Year 2000, I guess. I'm a tech background kind of guy, ended up in the language industry. How did you manage that? Like, I mean, you've worked for them for a while and you managed that transition. Just take us back a little bit and see. Okay. I've done the corporate corridors. Now I got to do something else. How did you do that?
Well, I will tell you, I started in EDS as a secretary in 1978. So yes, I'm old. I'm 73 years old and I still love what I'm doing. So I'm still doing it. But I started as a secretary there in 1978. And I left 21 years later as a corporate officer of a Fortune 50 company. And so when I think about that time, we grew from $350 million in revenue, $18.5 billion in revenue, 6 countries to 67. I mean, all kinds of, extrapolations of big numbers, right? I mean, that's what I think about. And I will tell you, I never set out to be, a corporate officer. And yet I'm an avid learner. And I pay attention and I take it all in and I connect dots. And I will tell you that other people saw things in me that I couldn't or didn't see in myself. and gave me opportunities beyond compare because of the growth. You know, when you're growing and changing in that regard, we need all hands on deck for everything all the time. So I had opportunities to do amazing things. And what I was able to do was go into a situation. I became a startup and kind of a turnaround specialist, if you will. I could go into a new situation and figure out what was wrong and figure out what needed to happen to get it fixed and back on the right track. And then when I got that done, I didn't get to rest on my laurels. They threw me into the next one.
Yeah.
Or I could see, they could say, here's a problem we need to solve or an opportunity we want to optimize. And I could take a blank sheet of paper and create, you know, what I thought would meet the need. And I also laughingly say, I took things off my boss's to-do list. I didn't put things on my boss's to-do list. So I operated very independently and autonomously. And we measured performance based on, did you get things done? Did you keep the customers happy? Did you develop your people? Did you leave it better than you found it? And all of those things were things that I grew up on. And that is, you know, in a nutshell, how I got from secretary to corporate officer.
So, you know, for people who are around you and the way you look at yourself, what is the, I want to call it the misconception that people probably you would think that people have about you?
Well, it goes to unconscious biases, you know, in my mind, and stereotypes. She's a woman, therefore she won't know about this, or she's a woman, therefore she's too emotional, or she's a woman, you know, and I want her to be the people pleaser that I have come to appreciate, you know, about women doing the stuff I don't want to do and all that kind of stuff. And so I think that the biggest misconception is I do know what's going on. I am smarter than you may realize. And I do play nice. I mean, I'm really great at developing relationships, and I can do hard things, whether it's hard tasks, hard conversations, hard decisions. I mean, all of that, I think, is there's always a surprise associated with that because we put women in little, you know, categories and buckets and think that's the only place they can play. And I will tell you, this is a very personal, but I'm a big sports enthusiast. And so I love football, and I can talk NFL football and college football with the best of them. And my husband has made bets and won bets based on my knowledge of what's going on. And so that's another surprise element.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, this is very surprising to me. Not in a way that you would think. I would say, you know, from the people I've met, from the, you know, that I've been frequented with, not many people, like even me, like I go to, when I live in Canada, so when I go to the US, I remember this one, I don't travel as much to the US now, but in past when I used to go to the US to see partners, customers, etc. And I know everybody loves to talk football. So in the morning in the hotel, like, you know, in front of the hotel door, hotel room door, there's a USA Today in front of the front of the door sometimes.
Yes.
And I don't know if they still do that. I used to pick it up, take the sports section, read it on my way to the meeting, just so I can have an engaging conversation. It's not like I know what football is.
Right. Yes. But you know, I share that with women that we need to be well-read, because if you're going to go into those rooms, so I always read like one of the, I would call it the Time or the Newsweek or the Business Week or whatever, because I wanted to know what was going on there. I would read the Wired or Forbes or Fortune to know what's going on in business. I would read People magazine, so I was up on pop culture, and then I would read Sports Illustrated because I wanted to know about the latest sports. Well, now we have all the news feeds, so that stuff's coming at us on a regular basis, and the more we read something, the more it shows up. Mm-hmm. And I believe you have to be, you know, have a broad range of knowledge and currency in order to be seen as credible, and how you fit into those scenarios.
So in, you know, I know you mentioned your age, and I won't repeat it, but you don't look your age, by the way. I just feel that you're much younger and vibrant than your age.
In my heart, I am much younger.
But have you seen the level of biases since you started changed over time? Did you see a pattern? Is it up, down, flat?
Yeah, very, very much there has been change and progress, and which quite honestly, I think is at risk again, because I think we're taking some backward steps. What I will tell you is, you know, I've grown up in a world, I would be involved in sports in some way if that had been available to me, but I was pre-Title IX, so we didn't have women's sports teams in my school, and I grew up right outside of Houston, Texas. near Dallas, Texas now, but I grew up outside of Houston. So big city, you know, it wasn't a matter. It didn't dawn on anybody that girls might like to play sports. And I remember women couldn't get credit cards. Women couldn't own cars or buy homes in their own names. Women couldn't initiate divorce. Women, you know, if there was domestic abuse, that was not a reason for getting a divorce. So, I mean, I look at all those things that have happened in my lifetime. And when I started looking at what women made in a compensation way, you know, we made probably around 50 something cents on the dollar than men did in the 70s and 80s. We're now up to 89 cents on the dollar for white women, much lesser numbers for women of color. And so I've seen those things happen from sort of the quantitative or the policy making perspective. What I also have seen is women are now included in health research or medical research because, you know, the best example I can always think of is women do not present having heart attacks in the same way as men do. We don't always do the same thing under stress that men do. We've also not been seen as being risk takers, but the difference is that as women, we have a contingency plan or a plan B, so it doesn't look like as much risk because we pivot to the backup plan, right? And so all of those kind of myths around these things have been busted. And we now understand that there are some things that are unique to women that we need to study. And I'll also tell you that there used to be one book a year, this started in the early 2000s, that was written about women in leadership. And every woman ran to get that book and read it. And now there's a multitude of books that are being written about it because we have more women examples and role models that we can learn from. I've never worked for a woman. There weren't any women, you know, in those roles before me. So we were making it up as we went, right? And we went through all the, you have to act like a man. Well, guess what? That doesn't work. Well, then if you act like a girl, then you're being too this or that. So we're either too much of this or not enough of that and all those kinds of things. And so I think, you know, the best part of this is that of the progress that we have made. And it's in thanks to people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and women who stood tall and in the heat and made changes to better represent women in all the ways, right? Whether it be financial, whether it be business, whether it be, you know, family, all of those things are now a whole lot better because women were brave and courageous.
So, Marcia, like the advocacy that you're doing right now and the issues that you're trying to, it sounds to me there are many other places in the world, you know, other than North America, that they're still living those issues now. You know, if you read the news, this is in some countries still there.
Very much so.
And it's not much talked about. And it's being considered, you know, tradition is being considered many other things. And I know, like, United States, Canada, North America in general is pretty much a new continent in comparison to other, you know,
yes.
Countries have been around for 10,000, whatever, how many years they've been around. So how much the issues that you're faced with, the women faced with in Canada, I'm trying to educate some of our listeners as well while I ask the question, are part of that, you know, either A, building a new country or building a new nation, and how do we get that modern society, modern life kind of thing, and ditching the old ways that came from whatever countries it came from, initially came from Europe, I guess. And also, how is that reflecting now on other countries, what you've learned throughout your career, what you've learned through your advocacy effort? Are these being transparently put out there for other countries to learn from?
I think there's a wide range of answers to your question.
I know it's a broad topic.
I
could have asked it in 200 ways.
But it's the elephant in the room, as they say, right? So what I will tell you is I have worked with women from over 60 countries, and I've delivered training in over 40 countries. And there are some universal truths for women. Now, I want to also clarify, I'm working with women who are part of business organizations. So they're typically going to be a more educated group and are dealing with the business issues around leadership, less so than community or societal issues in their area. The universal truths that I find with women are they are typically seen as support resources or one, I call it one down versus, you know, men are in the one up, women are in the one down. So their ideas are dismissed. The roles that are available to them are limited to more support type roles. Their voices are, it's a seen, not heard kind of environment. I had a woman from Japan that I was coaching. She had been part of a program I delivered there. And she asked me, she said, you know, when you're a single woman, they work you to death. When you get married, they're more sympathetic to your hours. And when you get pregnant and have a child, you're expected to stay home. And we don't want to stay home. We feel like we can be good mothers and we can also be good employees of whatever sort it may be. And her request of me was, will you talk to our company? Because my contract was with her company. Will you talk to the company about on-site childcare? Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I won't talk to them, but I'm going to coach you on how to go have that conversation. And perhaps it's more than just you, because there's always power in numbers. But they need, what I know about most countries, most organizations, is we need both men and women. And when you look at it in that way, there was a headline during, I think it was the 2008 financial debacle here in the U.S. around mortgages and all that kind of stuff. One of the headlines was, if Lehman Brothers had been Lehman Brothers and sisters, they might have survived. Right? So this idea of, we need the compassion of women at the table. We need the strength of women considering things from a risk perspective, a planning perspective, an organizing perspective at the table to balance out the, we're just going to go in and, you know, ramrod the answer, or it's going to be focused on power, greed. And quite honestly, around the world, if you look at domestic abuse and how women and girls are treated as property, as cattle, as, you know, I mean, it breaks my heart. And, you know, one of my hashtags and many of the things that I do is hashtag value women and girls, because we aren't valued in those ways. And so I think if you're an emerging country, that engaging the women along with the men at the table to do amazing things, you have a much better chance of moving things along in the direction that you want them to move. Because we know that you need the psychological buy-in and you need the commitment of everybody to affect big changes. And so I think engaging women is extraordinarily important.
Absolutely. I mean, just from a statistic point of view, I mean, if you were to say 50-50, the world is split, and you devalue or however you want to, you know, discount 50% of the population of the world altogether, imagine the damage you do versus uplifting that 50%. Imagine the good they will do.
I know. It's heartbreaking. I mean, it really, really breaks my heart.
You're supposed to live in an equal world.
Yes. Well, there's the book Half the Sky that was written by Nicholas Kristof, and it was about in China, you know, that, and I think about, you know, how they did not care for girl babies. And so that was a high adoption rate that where they went to other countries and, you know, the one child rule, and they saved the men. And so now, you know, again, taking a longer term view, which of course China is known for taking the longer view, but you look at that and you say, okay, now there's a bunch of men over there who can't find wives. Duh, do the math.
I know.
You know, I mean, it's mind-boggling to me that you know, they
basic arithmetic, Marcia,
figure that out, you know, and all of that. So I really believe, and we have to start with our children. And I think in many countries we have to do, I'll call it, outrageous things. Do you remember in Saudi Arabia when they had the women drive day? Women didn't know how to drive, and they would show these pictures of women in cars who, you know, risked a lot to go out there and drive that car, and they would end up on sidewalks and, you know, all those kinds of things. But it's that kind of courage and, you know, boldness that gets people's attention. You know, in America, there was a book called Nice Girls Don't Get the Corner Office, or if you're going to get ahead, you got to break a little glass. And, you know, we have all those things, but there are women out there who are just trying to figure out how to get to drive, you know, which things that we take for granted. And, you know, I mean, as I said, when I lived through times when you couldn't get a credit card in your name and all that kind of stuff, we want to make women financially dependent so that they don't have choices and options.
You know, as I hear you talk about this, you know, it's fascinating that, you know, you've spent pretty much most of your life advocating for these issues. You've seen a lot of changes, hopefully to the positive. Lots of work still need to be done, I assume.
Yes.
In a lot of areas.
Yes.
But at a various levels, as you mentioned earlier, like some people are saying, no, I didn't get the corner office, but some other people in some other countries still say, well, I can't vote.
That's right.
So how do I do with that? So at various level of support, I'm assuming, right?
It is, yeah.
So when you launched that, you know, Power of Self program, and this is one of your program, I guess the early one, and then you have Expanding Your Power later. I'm assuming economically, a lot of corporation probably would think, you know, what is this? It's going to cost me either whatever it is, you know, maternity leaves or whatever they're asking for or whatever the ask is in this case. Did you get a lot of pushback from corporate? And what was the reaction? I guess that would be, what was the interaction with these guys?
You can tell the smile on my face. I experienced a lot of things there. So I started these programs in the early 2000. And I'll tell you that in the U.S., other than college programs that were about women's history, there weren't women's leadership development programs. And so there was one place that came close, and it was in San Francisco. And believe it or not, it was called the Bully School, where you send your women to smooth off their rough edges, was the tagline. Now, this was in the 2000s, early 2000s. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding. This cannot be real.
It's just, I never heard of that. This is crazy.
It is crazy. And so when I would go in and talk to people about here's what I want to do, here's what I've designed, here's what it's going to cost, here's the da-da-da. So some people got it, and I had 26 people in my very first class, and they represented a lot of different companies. Others were like, I could tell it, they challenged everything. So if I send my women to this class, are they going to come, you know, march in front of the building and complain about everything and, you know, burn their bras and do all those things that were happening in the 60s? And I said, look, you know, I can't promise you what your people are going to do. I don't know what they're going to do. But if you want to engage them, if you want to have a strong pipeline of good leaders, then you have an opportunity here. There were some of them that I know maybe weren't the final decision maker in their company, but they really wanted it. And they would say all the right things, and I'd love to. And I also had this sense, and I checked with them later, and it was true, of the, that's a great idea, Marcia. Good luck with that. You know, kind of under their breath, good luck with that. And, you know, we delivered the program for 20 years, and I won't tell you that it wasn't hard, because we launched the first one 3 weeks after 9/11. I mean, there were lots of big decisions that I had to make that had financial implications, that had reputation, and yet, you know, I'll tell you this too, Robin. Men told me, because I gave away the first program, and I want to tell you, it was a very sophisticated program, and that was a $300,000 decision. And I gave it away because I believed in what we were doing. And that's a woman's way. I believed in what I was doing. And I had not taken money from any investors because I didn't want them telling me what to do. And when I talked to men about what to do after the 9/11, because I was having women say, my company's not going to pay for it. We don't know what's going to happen. And I understood that. That was all very understandable. The men said, women won't value it if they don't pay for it. And I didn't think that was true. And guess what? I had gotten millions of dollars of business from the women that got to come to that very first program, because they valued the learning.
That's right.
It wasn't a dollar value.
Planting the seeds, basically.
Yeah. And for some of them, it was an immediate return on investment. For others, mm-hmm. It took a while because maybe they weren't sitting at the table where they had the budget authority to, you know, write a check. But when they got there, they still remembered it because they were using the tools that they had learned in the program. And so the value of that is alive and well still today. I get messages from people who were in many of the early programs talking about how they're still using the tools, how they still have their notebooks in front of them, how they still refer to it, and how they're, you know, sharing that with other women in their lives.
And do you have like a community, Marcia, developed around these programs? You still have those communities alive and well?
We do. So you can subscribe on my website, and I'm assuming you'll give them all that information as part of this. But yeah, you can subscribe. We did a reunion just recently, and we had people from all the different programs. Even if you were just, if you had just read my books or listened to my podcast, you could come, because this is a like-minded women who want to do better for, you know, to develop their own capabilities, but then to, you know, pay it forward in lifting others up.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned those programs, and I'm sure you have a whole bunch of anecdotes. Just for the listeners, if you don't mind, can you tell us about a situation where women came in to the program and they left, but not left the same? They changed completely after they went through the program, basically reinvented themselves. Is there such thing?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we have anecdotes and testimonials, not only from the women themselves, but from their bosses and even from their clients, right? Where they came back with greater clarity. They came back with greater competence. They came back with greater productivity. They came back with greater confidence. And that confidence piece is amazingly important. It's like they found their voice somewhere along the way. And it happens at different times for different people. And I would often say after our first, they were typically 3-day sessions, and they would come back after the first session and they would say, there's something different about Marcia. I can't quite put my finger on it, but you know, there's something there. And then the next time around, it would be the, oh my gosh, she stood up in this meeting and she changed the direction of the meeting and blah, 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 blah. We also have all those quantitative metrics about how many get promoted and how many increase their compensation and financial position and those kinds of things as well. What kind of leadership roles they're moving into with greater influence and impact. And so there's a lot of those. But, you know, what I say is we're not here to fix you because you're not broken. And what we want to do is help you either discover parts of yourself that maybe you didn't know were in there, or to get back in touch with those parts of yourself that were there once, but you've lost along the way. And, you know, that's where it's like coming back home. And I will also tell you, Robin, that many of the women that came into my programs, this was the first time they'd been in a room full of women, just women only. Yeah. And what I know about programs when it's women only, you get to ask the questions you wouldn't ask if there were men in the room. And you get to have conversations that you would not have if there were men in the room. And that's the difference, because the content of leadership is the same. And because women are often an only one, they can feel very isolated. So to be in a room full of other women makes them feel not crazy, not isolated. Yeah.
I'm not the only one who's feeling this. So
that's right. Oh my gosh. You've had that experience. I thought it was just me.
Yeah.
And so there's also, though, a wariness about going into a room of women, because not always women have not always treated other women well. Right. So there's a whole, you know, passel of stories about women not treating other women well. And so one of the big principles of my programs and work is women supporting women, not blindly. Not, I'm not going to support you just because you're a woman. But you know what? I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt, and I'm not going to compete with you, and I'm not going to gossip about you, and I'm not going to say, did you believe what she's wearing today? You know, all of that kind of stuff. The pettiness of seventh grade stuff is what I describe it as. No, we're here to help each other. We're here to support each other. When one boat, you know, one woman lifts all boats kind of thing, you know, whereas I think we operated, and when I think about my generation, the baby boomer generation, we operated on, yeah, we were told we could be anything, but the reality was we were teachers, nurses, secretaries, and stay-at-home moms. Nothing wrong with any of those. And yet that was a pretty small list.
That's right.
And so we fought, and there was an unspoken competition because there was really only one seat at the table for a woman. And by golly, I want it. But I would never say that out loud because good girls don't talk like that. You know. And so there's all of that that happened. And women often paid a price for that if they fought to have that seat. And there was, you know, books all about that. The queen bee syndrome. I had it hard and I'm going to make it hard for every other woman. I mean, and we've gotten past so much of that. And there really is an opportunity to support one another in meaningful ways.
And, you know, again, I'm assuming, and you're the expert, you tell me, correct me if I'm wrong, societal impact on, you know, the generations that have been before us and the current generation is going to come after us, has been clouding a lot of the judgment, a lot of the behavior, a lot of what we think of ourselves. Because as you mentioned earlier, like some people come to your program, they think they're not worthy, etc. But once you've isolated them, it's like having put them back into a laboratory where, you know, you're not outside, you're not in the world right now, you're in your own world. And you, from there, you can create whatever you want to create. Basically, here's your blank sheet of paper, if I'm reading you correctly.
That's right.
Your own world. Am I correct by saying that?
You're absolutely right about all of that, because we do get all the messages about good girls, color inside the lines, you know, you can never brag, don't, all of those things. And I don't say you need to brag on yourself. My formula is results plus recognition equals influence. Women get results. They get stuff done. They can multitask with the best of them. That sometimes works against us, by the way, but we can get it done. What we fail to get is oftentimes is the recognition. And guess what? We often collude in our own, you know, demise or our own marginalization in that way, because we deflect praise, because good girls don't, you know, they don't do that, right? So if someone says to me, Marcia, you did a great job on this project, my likely first response will be, oh, it wasn't me, it was the team, or it was nothing. Right? I diminish not only the work that was done, but I diminish my part in it. And so my teaching around that is, when you take yourself out of the story, you're giving everyone else permission to do the same. And so what I put underneath that recognition part is I, the pronoun I plus we. So when someone tells you you did a good job, you say to them, you know, I am proud of the leadership that I provided, and I had a great team to work with. So you're not taking your team out of the story, but you're also not taking yourself out of the story. That's not bragging. That's not, you know, anything other than acknowledging I did work really hard on this. Men don't think a second time about it oftentimes when we speak in those terms. Now, if it's all about I, that's a whole different issue, and one that's not unique to women or men. We can all suffer from that. But we as women need to understand how to showcase our contributions and our talents and our abilities in meaningful ways. And so we get a lot of societal messages about being good girls, but we have to redefine what good girls means.
Yeah. And I completely get the, you know, there are two gender, one gender uses I too much. One doesn't use I enough.
And enough.
I think it's just a bit of a balance. We'll bring everybody to a good level.
And I think so too.
Now I agree with where you're going with that one. That's pretty cool. Now the, for the audience, you know, if we have like two things, expanding your power and embracing your power, right? So if embracing your power was chapter one and expanding your power was chapter two, for instance, in this case, what has to actually look different in a leader to see the behavioral changes or the difference between the two?
So embracing your power, all of the work that I do is around a specific model. We start with self-awareness. Mm. We then go to interpersonal relationships. We then go to teams or groups, and then we go to organization. And so these books are organized in that same way, because what I did was take this 19-day program. I wrote about the first three six modules. I wrote about the first three modules in book one. I wrote about the second three modules. So they're distinct and different, but they build on each other. But the part of starting with self-awareness, Robin, is if I don't know me, I can't even begin to know you. Nor can I be empowered to know who I want to show up to be, right? So we're often aspiring to be better or more or whatever. Going back to those societal messages, we either get the message of we're not enough or we're too much, right? So we can display the same behaviors as men, but it can be viewed negatively. For a woman to be ambitious suddenly or certainly has a negative connotation. But for men, that's a leadership trait, right? Women are bossy, men are leaders. You know, I mean, all of that kind of stuff is going on. But what I would say about all of that is we've got to start with that self-awareness. What are my strengths? What are my habits? What are my patterns? What are my defaults? And then we've got to go to, how do I use those to show up as the person I want to be or the leader I want to be? And then, okay, how do I want to interact on a one-on-one, those interpersonal relationships where we talk about how do you build trust? That's a huge part of building relationships. And relationships that are not based on a foundation of mutual trust they're shaky relationships, right? 100%. So you want meaningful relationships, you gotta start with how you build trust. We have a framework for building trust with it. Here are the behaviors, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So that's book one. So the subtitle being A Woman's Path to Authentic Leadership and Meaningful Relationships. And that authentic part is none of us are going to do it exactly the same way. So, you know, in the first book, we talk about what are your values and how do you live those values? Because if I make choices and decisions based on my values, I like them a whole lot better. But I got to know what my values are. So again, going there. Then the second book, Expanding Your Power. And power in this world, or in my, the context of my work, is I have the power to choose who I want to be. I have the power to make those free will decisions day in and day out 100 times a day. So without that clarity of knowing who I am, that's why that self-awareness piece is, but I've got to be able to have the clarity of that to build the relationships. And so the authentic part is each of us is going to do that in different ways, playing to our different strengths. And then the second book, the subtitle is A Woman's Opportunity to Inspire Teams and Influence Organizations. So inspiring teams is about setting expectations, providing feedback, removing roadblocks, recognizing good performance, the understanding of group dynamics about creating psychologically safe environments for people to contribute their best work, how to handle conflict situations, how to make group decisions. There's different processes and styles and ways to do all of that. Also in leading change efforts, and that could be either team or organizational. And then all the organizational dynamics around power, around policy, around practice, around planning, pay structures, that's the ability to influence organizations to bring more equity and fairness to the world so that women don't make 89 cents on the dollar or less in, you know, various countries. And so we start with you and then we go big, right? And so that's the two books. And I will tell you, Robin, together, these are their own leadership development programs. So if your company or your organization doesn't have it or isn't willing to invest in it, you can take these two books and they're full of frameworks, checklists, tools, roadmaps, blueprints, reflection questions. You can read it individually or you can do it with a reading, a book club, a reading group, a women's resource group, a mentoring circle. There's a variety of ways because it's about availability of it. Everybody can't go to a program. Affordability of it. Most people can afford a book. You know, then you get to use it and it's a resource for you forevermore.
And I'm assuming, Marsha, that, you know, when let's say some of your program participants or get influenced by it, they see the light, I guess, for the lack of better expression, and they want to drag somebody else along with them, right? They want to bring somebody else along with them. And that's the leadership, I'm assuming, that's part of that as well, right? I've seen it. It worked. Let me show you what I learned.
Yes. I had a woman send me a note yesterday. She's using the book and they're going a chapter a month. It's a mentor, a person that she's mentoring, a high potential woman in her organization, who's a young, bright woman. And she wrote me back, sent me a copy of the note that this woman had sent to her. And it was about guilt. You know, we as women often, because we're either told we're not enough or we're too much and we feel guilty and we're working mothers and I'm not a good mother and I'm not a good this and all of that. And so the idea of sacrifice versus choice, so it's that reframing, because if I focus on sacrificing what I can't do or what I'm not doing versus every choice we make, Robin, whether it's you or me or anybody else out there, there's going to be trade-offs, right? I'm going to get something and I'm going to give something up. I mean, almost every choice requires us to go through that analysis. And so I have to and want to make choices. And think about it as I did the analysis and I'm going to get more than I give up. So am I giving up something? Yes. But is it this sacrifice? Because that's such a heavy word that then the guilt gets us attached to it. And so now I'm walking around going, I'm a loser, you know, all of that kind of thing. And that's not what this is about. Go create the life you want and make choices accordingly. And, you know, that is an empowering place to be, is when I recognize that I have the right to make those choices. They're not all going to be easy. And sometimes I have to stand in the heat of my choices. You know, sometimes it's like living my values, which I think is part of the authenticity aspect of this, you know.
Even if sometimes the choice is wrong in some cases.
That's right.
Yeah, it's your choice.
That's right. I'm making it. And when I wake up in the morning and look in the mirror, I like the person looking back at me because I did it based on values, ethics, integrity, professionalism, you know, the things that I place great value on.
Marcia, you did a good talk on Women Do Not Ask, and you've done that through my research, I guess. You know, Fortune 50 experience, probably people were there and they're participating in it. Based on that talk, maybe you can walk us through what is the worst advice women still get till today from various groups, and the language in the performance review, probably that it's probably more damaging than it's doing good in corporations and to some of these women, and where some well-meaning men and groups, etc., are still missing the mark.
Well, so I want to give credit to Babcock and Lashever in their book that they wrote called Women Don't Ask, because that's what prompted me to kind of go on this journey of this. And here's what I want to say to you. Men ask for what they want 2.5 times more than women do. And the phrase or the concept label there is asking propensity. So if men ask for what they want 2.5 times more than women, the likelihood of them getting 2.5 times more than women is really good. Right? I mean, again, it's a math thing. So there's that. Then there's something called the likability factor. Women and men, when they're asking for something, need to bring the facts, present the business case, right? Do your homework, and so on. Women have an additional requirement, if you will, to be likable. So they're referred to often as communal behaviors. So we have to smile when we ask for it. We have to be non-threatening, non-confrontational. And so what I say to women is, I don't like it. And yet if I know it, my goal is to get what I want. So if I have to smile when I ask for what I want, then I'm going to smile. Because you know what? That's good for me. And I wish we didn't have to do it. But when I know better, I can do better. So this is about making an informed choice, an informed decision. So asking propensity, likability factor. The third is around, it's called the self schema, which is how I see myself. It's referred to as the inner portrait. Do I think I'm worthy of getting more money or getting whatever it is I want and ask for? So it could be a bigger budget. It could be another headcount. It could be, you know, whatever it might be. I have to do my own work to say, if that's going to enable my team to perform better, then it's okay. We're really good at advocating on behalf of others or asking on behalf of others, but not for ourselves. So that whole self-schema thing, that inner portrait, that self-talk. Then the next one is childhood socialization. So there's a lot of work around the rules that are learned on the playground are the same rules we bring into the workplace. And boys do more scorekeeping, play more scorekeeping games, more about competition, more about dominance, more about alpha male, more about all that. Girls are about being nice. You don't keep score. Everybody gets a turn, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And so we bring those with us. So we're still taking turns and making sure everybody's okay. And then the last one that I think is probably the most, it's just startling, is called the accumulation of disadvantage. And this is where organizations have to be really smart. And many of them are. The whole sunshine, you know, thinking around making things visible instead of it's all secret in the back room, you know, where we're deciding. But here's the example I'll walk you through. A man and a woman come out of college. They have similar majors, extracurriculars, GPAs, grade point averages, all that kind of stuff. So they look pretty similar on paper. The starting salary for the job they're both going after is, let's just say, you know, $35,000 a year. And what happens is men on average negotiate about another 4.5% above that $35,000. Women about 2.5%. So when you just apply those numbers, it's only about a $500 annual difference. That's not exactly specific, but directionally correct. I don't want to go through the point, blah, blah, blahs. But the reality is no one would notice that. In my corporate world, I started the compensation department at EDS and I ran it a couple of different times. And I've worked with other organizations in my current entrepreneurial business doing those kinds of things. Nobody would pay attention. It would be a rounding error. But what happens, the accumulation of disadvantage, if you extrapolate 4.5% and 2.5%, by the time they're 65, which is, you know, often a retirement age, he's making $212,000 and she's making $110,000. So when you start adding that up over time, you now begin to understand why we make 89 cents on the dollar or 57 cents or 42 cents or whatever it has been. So again, if we want it to be different, we have to ask for it different. And here's what I tell people. Always know your market value for the job that you have and the job that you're going after.
And there's plenty of sources now to identify that, right?
That's right.
It's not a mystery anymore.
And you're not comparing yourself to another person. You're comparing yourself to market data. That makes it, oh, she's too emotional. You know, takes that out of the equation.
Yeah, yeah.
You also can scare your boss because you're smart about it. And that makes them sit up and listen. So know your market value. You can never overcome a low starting salary. So if you're in a job interview, here's what you do. And they say, what are your compensation expectations? Here's the language I teach to women. I know that the market value for this job is, let's just say, $125,000 to $175,000 a year. Based on my track record of experience and results, I would expect to be paid at the high end of that range. And then they're going to ask you, well, what do you make now? And here's what you say to them. It doesn't matter what I make now. I know the market value of that job, and that's what my expectations are. Now, I have to decide, am I going to walk away from a job because they don't pay me at the high end, or will they at least start me at the mid? But here's what often happens. We get the promise of it'll come, and it never comes. And it never comes because the economy gets bad, or that boss is gone, and it's nowhere on the record. So you got to start over with me, the new boss. And that's why when you agree to something that is lesser than what you want to follow that up with an email and you want to send it to the HR department as well as your boss, because now you have a record of, they told me they would look at this again in 6 months. And if my performance warranted, I would get the increase. And so all of that is critically important for me to improve my financial security, because that thousand, you know, basically half, that impacts if you're in a bonus program where it's a percentage of bonus, if you're contributing to the Social Security system in America, all of that is impacted. So the accumulation is not just year over year. It's on all the ancillary things that are based on, you know, what your salary is.
Stock program and all that stuff. So it gets all impacted.
All that.
You know what? I can talk to you forever. It's a beautiful conversation we're having today and enlightening. I've learned a lot from this conversation, Marcia. I really appreciate it. And as we wrap up here, what are you hoping to achieve with this particular podcast? What is your hope and desire from this conversation, I guess?
My hope and desire is to reach women around the world and give them not only hope or aspiration, but information and tools to go believe differently, to act differently, to challenge, to do it together. There's power in numbers. And, you know, if we all go together and try to make changes, and to not lose heart and to know they're not alone. And again, I go back to three things: availability, accessibility, and affordability. Because I know the economics are different for women in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. And I want women to have access to this.
Yep.
And if you are a woman who has the means, help women have access who don't have the means. And so that's about sharing stories, buying books. I mean, it could be any and all of that, because if we know better, we can do better. I mean, that's Maya Angelou's quote, you know, do the best you can until you know better. And when you know better, do better. I mean, I believe in that. And so we have to be able to make informed choices. But if I don't even have access to information, I'm still sitting over here thinking I'm the only one that's experiencing this and I'm the one that's crazy.
Don't be afraid of speaking up or reaching out to somebody or ask questions.
That's right. find your voice and find, you know, your tribe, find 100%, your sisterhood.
100%. For the audience, for the listeners that came along with us for the ride for this particular podcast, I really appreciate your time. Marcia Clark, thank you so much for coming online with me today to record this podcast. Pleasure meeting you.
Yeah, I appreciate it as well. And I love your questions because they're the right questions. You know, the quality of our questions says a lot about who we are. And I love the quality of your questions. And I think they're common questions that many of us are wrestling with on a regular basis. So thank you very much.
100%. And I, for the audience, if anybody wants to reach out to Marcia and they don't know how, just reach out to my LinkedIn profile. Hit me up. I'll introduce you to Marcia 100%. No problem. I'll facilitate an introduction. Marcia, I sent you a LinkedIn connection. If you don't mind, when you get a chance, prove that for me. I really appreciate it. And then everything we do on the channel here, post this podcast, I'll tag you with it. You know, your team can do whatever they wish to do with it, share it and broadcast it to their own, amplify it to their own networks. Feel free to use it the way you want to.
Well, that you said amplify it. Amplification is also something we teach. So.
That's right.
Because again, there's strength in numbers, and it may be as simple as I agree with you 1,000%. And that's been my experience as well. I mean, it can be as simple as that, but it's amplifying and emphasizing the important points that of women's stories and women's voices.
Absolutely. For the audience, thanks so much for following us along here, and I appreciate it. And I'll see you at the next episode 134, next time we record one. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. And until next time.